If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Tuesday, October the 22nd. Welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Hoover Institution's Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Research Fellow. My guest today here in Hoover's recording studio on the campus of Stanford University is Captain Christopher Sharman, United States Navy. Captain Sharman is a Hoover National Security Affairs Fellow, and in addition to his time at sea, a former U.S. Naval Attaché in Vietnam and China. He's a distinguished graduate from the Naval War College, a published author and recipient of the 2015 National Defense University President's Award for Excellence in Writing, and the United States Navy League's 2016 Alfred Thayer Mahan Award for Literary Achievement. Welcome to the podcast, Captain Sharman.
Bill, it's great to be here. Thank you very much.
To clarify before we get into this, you are a naval officer, but you're not here representing the United States Navy. What you're about to say are your opinions and hopefully do not get you in trouble with the brass.
Perfect, and I appreciate that.
Very good. Well, first, welcome to Stanford, and let's explain to me the life of the naval attaché. My father was a naval reservist. I understand the Navy way. I understand life at sea. I understand life on shore for the most part, but tell me exactly what an attaché does.
Sure. The attaché is the primary responsibility of an attaché is to represent United States military policy overseas to your host country. Mm-hmm. It gives me an opportunity, gives all attachés an opportunity to engage directly with your host government, to engage with their military, and in hopefully to advance the bilateral military relationship between the two countries.
Mm-hmm. And the years you served in China and Vietnam?
I was in Beijing from 2009 to 2012, a very dynamic time in our relationship. And then most recently in Hanoi from 2016 to 2019, so just came out of Hanoi just a few months ago.
And give me an idea of your opinions of being an attaché versus serving at sea. Do you prefer one or the other?
Well, to be an effective attaché in the Navy, I think it's very important to have some time at sea.
Right.
It's what gives you credibility as an attaché. Mm-hmm. In terms of preference, I very much enjoy the diplomatic life. It's you can't complain about having to do the cocktail circuit,
right,
and to spend some time advancing foreign policy over a drink.
And you sailed in the Pacific, right?
I have been a Pacific sailor my entire career, almost two decades in the Pacific.
Is that normal for the branch to do one ocean over the other?
It's increasingly becoming more normal. The Navy is promoting people to get some specialization in a region if they can. In the past, there was a time when they would try and balance a career between the Atlantic and the Pacific, but increasingly you can do an entire career focused on one region as long as you take those jobs of higher responsibility along the way.
Right. And how long have you been in the Navy, and when did you get your fourth stripe?
I was came into the Navy back in 1993, so that's now over 26 years.
Mm-hmm.
Had no intention of staying in this long, and became a captain back in 2015.
And is there such a thing as a pivot year in the Navy? Is it your fourth year, your tenth year? When do you really start deciding if this is going to be a career path or not?
For me, probably
varies from individual, but what was your turning point?
For me, I have stayed in, and my philosophy has always been, I will stay in as long as I'm having fun.
Mm-hmm.
There is not necessarily a specific time. There are people who, of course, get in and out of the Navy or get out of the Navy a bit later in their year. But once you pass the 10-year point, at that point, you're really looking at retirement at the 20-year point, or at least having a retirement 20-year point. So there's a big disincentive for getting out after about the 10-year point.
Very good. So, Chris, the year 2020 is an important benchmark in two respects. First of all, it's the 45th anniversary of the U.S. evacuation from Saigon. Secondly, it's the second anniversary of a U.S. aircraft carrier arriving in Vietnam, the Carl Vinson. Now, a naval ship making a visit to Vietnam is not in itself breaking news, and let's talk a bit about how you handled such trips. But the Vinson showing up for a four-day stop off of Da Nang was significant. Tell me why.
Well, actually, there's another significant date that 2020 marks, but just to preempt you on that.
Okay.
2020 is also the 25th anniversary of bilateral relations between
right,
Vietnam and the United States. So it's
right,
a very significant year ahead, and the potential for overall cooperation, not just in the military realm, but also through the entire relationship, it has great potential. In terms of the carrier visit, it was the first post-war carrier visit to Vietnam in March of 2018.
Mm-hmm.
Really was a culmination of what had been a series of closer collaboration with the Vietnamese military over the last several years. Right. We've really, since Spike, the relationship has really progressed relatively rapidly since early 2016. We've had a number of ship visits that the number of ship visits as a whole increased dramatically over that period of time, whereas we would normally have just one visit or two visits a year. During the period from 2016 to 2018, we had 18 ships come in. So Vietnam was very interested in advancing the relationship. There were some strategic reasons, I think, behind that, with some issues that they had with China back in 2014. But the carrier coming in sent a very strategic message that military collaboration with the United States had advanced to a point where some of the the relationship as a whole had moved to a point where we were ready to continue to move forward. We had normalized a relationship, and that Vietnam was willing to collaborate with the United States to stand up to China by bringing in an aircraft carrier.
And a carrier is a very special vessel. There are only, what, 12 in the Navy, and it's the equivalent, I guess, of what Teddy Roosevelt once got out with the Great White Fleet. It is the big stick. It is the most overt expression of American power you can send an aircraft carrier.
It is. As I understand it, when you're in the Situation Room, and I have not been in the Situation Room, one of the first questions that the president will ask is, where are the carriers when a crisis comes up? So exactly. Certainly a very strategic message that you can send around the world.
Well, let's get into the Vietnamese strategic relation, especially with China. But first, a couple questions about life in Vietnam. What is it like to be walking around on the streets of Hanoi and Vietnamese cities as a white man, looking like an American?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, when I went to Vietnam, I had some preconceived notions that that because of the 10 years of war that we had fought with them, that it was going to be very difficult as an American over in Vietnam.
Right.
You know, we had a very bloody relationship with the North, of course. But I got over there, and I was very surprised that it was incredibly well received. You know, when you sit down and you really talk with the Vietnamese about the relationship, they'll very quickly tell you that we fought 10 years of war with you, and it was a very difficult time. An entire generation of our people were for the most part wiped out. But in the next breath, they'll tell you, you know, before we fought you, we fought the French for 100 years. And before we fought the French, we fought the Chinese for 1,000 years. Oh, and by the way, after we fought you, we fought the Chinese again a couple of times.
Right.
That really helps put it in perspective for where we fall. It's a very important thing to honor our war legacy and our mutual, you know, history that we have together. But Vietnam as a people are very much looking forward. So as a person walking around Vietnam, I think the biggest challenge is not the people. It is the crossing the street, which is, I think, the most difficult thing to do in Vietnam with the number of scooters.
In terms of talking to the Vietnamese people, getting past government officials, people who have studied the United States, just talking to men and women on the street, restaurant people, you know, business people and so forth, what is their attitude toward America? Do they understand America?
They understand the ideals of America, and the United States has a favorability rating over there of about 90%. It's astronomically high. I think there's more favorability for the United States in Vietnam than maybe in the United States sometimes. Mm-hmm. But by way of comparison, that same poll looking at China, the favorability towards China is about 10 to 15%. So it really shows where we stand as a country over there with Vietnam. So there's a lot of potential for our relationship as a whole to grow.
I read a headline recently, Chris, in a publication called The Diplomat, and the headline read, quote, Vietnam confronts China alone, with the following subhead, quote, Hanoi has not found as much support as it hoped for despite its bold confrontation in the South China Sea. What is the bold confrontation? And let's talk now about the Vietnamese-Chinese relationship.
Sure. Vietnam, since early July, Chinese vessels have been infringing on Vietnamese sovereignty.
Naval vessels.
Naval vessels. These are a combination of actually primarily Coast Guard vessels and what they would call maritime militia vessels. Mm-hmm. It's also a Chinese survey vessel that has come into Chinese waters, the economic exclusion zone. Mm-hmm. The economic exclusion zone for any country is exclusive economic zone is about 200 miles in distance. And what that zone allows a country to do is to extract the mineral resources, to operate in there, and do what fish, everything that it needs Any country that wants to come into that zone needs to ask permission of the host nation to be right. able to do that. So China has been sending its vessels to infringe upon Vietnamese sovereignty into this region since early July. These vessels have been coming in and out of the waters over a protracted period of time, and then periodically have gone back to some of these Chinese features in the South China Sea that they did some land reclamation and resupplying, and then coming right back into Vietnamese waters. What the Chinese appear to be doing is to thwart ongoing efforts by Vietnam to collaborate with Russia, in fact, to do some oil extraction down in an area called Vanguard Bank. Vanguard Bank is down southeast of Vung Tau area, mm-hmm. well within Vietnam's exclusive economic zone. And it also falls in an area that China claims within its nine-dash line. Nine-dash line, of course, is that large U-shaped line that right. China claims basically 90% of the South China Sea. And China doesn't like that Vietnam's down there working with Russia to try and extract resources in what China would say is their water. So China's trying to pressure Vietnam right now and is really probing to see how far they can go. Quite honestly, I think it's going to have the opposite effect on China.
And what is your sense as to the Beijing view of Hanoi? On the one hand, it's not the refugee headache that could be North Korea. It's also not a military threat. I assume if China and Vietnam got into a military engagement, it would be a very one-sided affair. But how do they view their neighbor to the south?
Yeah, they have a long and complicated relationship.
Right.
It's a very careful relationship. They have what's called a strategic comprehensive partnership. That's one of only three countries that Vietnam has a strategic comprehensive partnership with, the other ones being Russia and India. So they have a very complicated relationship. They also have a very long history. Vietnam, from Vietnam's perspective, they very much understand China. They understand the way China thinks. They understand the way they approach things. But Vietnam and China have to live next to each other. Mm-hmm. It's very, very important that they maintain good relations. And so that makes the United States' collaboration with Vietnam that much more difficult. There's only so much we can do with Vietnam that might potentially provoke a response from China, China potentially putting pressure on Vietnam to not collaborate as closely as they might like to with the United States.
Right. Now, Vietnam has a Blue Water Navy, the Vietnam People's Navy. In April, a frigate from that Navy made its first visit to Myanmar. In May, three Indian naval vessels made a five-stop day in Chenang. And a couple of years ago, 2017, the Vietnamese Navy commissioned the last of 2 6 Russian-made diesel attack subs. How does Vietnam play into this rather complicated situation now that it's the South China Sea?
Like you mentioned earlier, Bill, Vietnam is not going to be able to stand up to China directly. Mm-hmm. What Vietnam can do, though, is make things very difficult for China. It can take it has some of the toys, it has some of the tools that it can actually perhaps bloody China's nose if something's to happen. But what Vietnam's real strategy here is to have a bunch of international partners that it can leverage right. to try and push back against China when China tries to assert greater sovereignty. So you right. mentioned the naval diplomacy is a great way that Vietnam does this, right. bouncing around the region and right. And making friends.
You have a word for this, balance. So let's explain to me the balanced approach of Vietnamese foreign policy right now.
Well, let me take a stab at the defense diplomacy side, because mm-hmm. I think that's perhaps where it's the most clear. Vietnam wants to maintain relations with both China and the United States, as well as all countries, and wants to advance all relationships. But the challenge that Vietnam has is, even if it wants to collaborate very closely with the United States, it of course is very concerned about what is China's reaction mm-hmm. going to be. So the analogy or the picture that I like to paint when I'm describing kind of the way they do a balancing and the way that they balance the relationship on the military side is, if you imagine a kind of a whiteboard, mm-hmm. and on that whiteboard, on the top column, there's a bunch of list of every single country that they have maybe defense relations with, or at least the main countries. Mm-hmm. That's going to be the United States, China, Japan, India, maybe Russia. Those countries may be listed at the top. On the left-hand side going down are the various bilateral activities that Vietnam may do on the military side. So as If the United States is to go and approach Vietnam about conducting a particular kind of activity, the Vietnamese Ministry of National Defense has to go to that little whiteboard and put a little check next to it, say, okay, we did this with the United States. Right. And if it does this with the United States, it then needs to put a check next to each one of these other countries, at least make that opportunity available to these various countries. So sometimes, Bill, sometimes when the United States approaches Vietnam, it's not that Vietnam doesn't want to do it with the United States. It's that they don't want to do it with China. And so that's why they will sometimes say no to us.
Interesting. So what is their goal with this foreign policy? What do they want to become a much more active world trader? Do they want to develop their economy more? Do they want more of a military presence? What do you think they're after?
I think Vietnam's ultimate objective is to be seen as a responsible stakeholder in the international community. Mm-hmm. From the military perspective, adhering to international norms, standards, rules, and laws are what Vietnam would like to do. It's also going to be a big year for Vietnam coming up. Mm-hmm. It's the host of ASEAN in 2020. It's also going to be taking a seat on the United Nations the United Nations Security Council. Oh. So it's a big year for Vietnam in the international community. It's a chance for Vietnam to really trumpet some of its positions. Mm-hmm. We don't know if it's going to push back very hard against China in this international forum, but if I was China right now, I'd not be trying to poke Vietnam in the eye because it's Vietnam has a megaphone right now.
So let's talk about Trump administration options since this is an Area 45 podcast. Is it naive for me to say that Trump could do with Vietnam what Richard Nixon did with China, using it as a country to off-balance a rival power? In Nixon's case, using China to off-balance the Soviets. In Trump's case, using Vietnam to throw the Chinese off-balance.
I think Vietnam is going to be looking at this in the long run. They're going to recognize that they do have to live next to China for a long time. So advancing the overall relationship, the Trump administration certainly could advance the overall relationship, perhaps elevate the relationship from what we call a comprehensive relationship now to a strategic relationship in the future, maybe highlighted by a presidential visit here, a Vietnamese president coming to Washington in the next year or so. What Vietnam has is it has what's called the three no policy. And it's important to understand what the three no policy is, because that's what is kind of a controls Vietnam's ability to move forward in a relationship with a country like the United States. Mm-hmm. The three no policy is no alliances, no foreign bases, and no working with any one country against the interests of another. In that way, by keeping that three no policy, Vietnam can maintain good relations with all countries, not only in the region, but around the world. It's also a policy that's very fungible, that Vietnam can use this policy to advance certain areas of a relationship, but can always point back to they have not changed their policy. So there's room for the Trump administration to advance the relationship with Vietnam, but I don't think we should be looking for an alliance with Vietnam.
Okay, very well put. Any conversation about Vietnam has to include at some point John McCain, the late John McCain. You had interactions with the senator during your time at Vietnam. Tell me about that.
I did. I had really the honor of hosting Senator John McCain aboard the USS John McCain in, I believe that was a year before his death, 2017, June of 2017. You know, this idea was actually percolated up at what I would call one of my bosses as the naval attaché, that being the Pacific Fleet. There was an admiral there who was in charge of the Pacific Fleet named Admiral Scott Swift. And he had had some interactions with Senator McCain at one point, and this was he saw this as a great opportunity to advance, to really celebrate the work that Senator McCain had done for advancing the relationship between Vietnam and the United States over years and years of activity. But right. With this many moving parts, you have a senator schedule, you have a ship schedule that has various operational requirements and maintenance requirements. Trying to sync these two visits up at the same time is quite challenging. Mm-hmm. Now, the stars finally aligned, and not only were we able to bring the USS John McCain in the ship, which is named after John McCain's father and grandfather. It's right. Named after both. Not only were we able to bring the ship in, we were able to bring it to a very strategic port called Cameron International Port. It's a port that just opened in 2016, and it's in one of the most sensitive areas of Vietnam, at least where their the largest military concentration is. It's not on the military side, it's on a commercial port side, but it's so it's a very sensitive thing. So it's a very strategic message, I believe, bringing the John McCain in and having the senator come on down. Now, I've got a little story about what happened.
You told me something went wrong. Something almost seriously messed up the event.
Well, you can imagine the eyes of my boss's boss were on me to make sure this went off without a hitch. Right. I was chartered with the responsibility to make this all to come together. On day one, in the morning, the USS John McCain arrived, and everything seemed to be going great. We did the paperwork, and everything was fine. Ships' crews do when they arrive in port, they unloaded a fair amount of guys, and they were able to go off and start enjoying town. Nha Trang is a great city in Vietnam and about an hour away, and so they were all very much enjoying the town of Nha Trang.
Liberty Call.
A Liberty Call, exactly right. About 4 o'clock that evening, I got a panicked call from some folks that were working down the ship saying the base has been closed. And I said, what do you mean the base has been closed? What am I supposed to do? Base has been closed. I have a ship down there. I have to get down to my ship.
Right.
Well, what we had is we had a situation where our visit by the USS John McCain was being hosted by the Foreign Relations Department of the Ministry of National Defense. The operational side of Vietnam's military decided to do a massive exercise right at the time when the USS John McCain is in the most sensitive military area of Vietnam. So what that meant is the base was closed. I had 100 and some odd sailors that were out in town enjoying life who couldn't get back to the ship. I couldn't get to the ship for a period of time. The next morning, John McCain is supposed to be coming down on the ship. So we had a real problem. Now, I called my contacts and was reassured that everything would be all right. We'll get this fixed. The problem is a very logistics part of a ship visit is when ships pull in, you have to be able to pump the sewage off.
Right.
The sewage was building up on this ship without the ability to pump the sewage off, without being able to get the trucks down to get the sewage off. We ran, and with John McCain, Senator John McCain, as well as Senator Barrasso and Senator Coons coming down the next day, I was dealing with a situation where I had tanks of sewage that were about to explode. So fortunately, about 6 o'clock in the morning, the next morning, we were able to navigate the Vietnamese bureaucracy, get the base opened back up, and get everyone down there in the right trucks to get down there. And fortunately, the senator came on, did some reenlistments, some promotions, and it worked out really well. And it was a real treat to see him because it was just 1 year later that he passed away. And this is before he had publicly announced what was going on.
And did you have any time to talk to him?
I sat down and had lunch with him, in fact. And so we sat across the table, and we talked a little bit about the history, and as well as with Senator Coons and Senator Barrasso, very interested in the Vietnamese relationship with the United States and where it could go on the military side. So it was a fantastic experience, and I think it honored what Senator McCain had done for the relationship between the United States and Vietnam.
And was McCain nostalgic during that lunch? Was he looking forward? It's fascinating to me because obviously this is an enormous defining moment of his life, being in prison in Hanoi. You go back to that country. Do you relive the past or do you talk about other topics?
Well, Senator McCain actually had come back to Vietnam a couple times over the last several years. And each time he would come back to Vietnam, he would take the congressional delegation, the Senate delegation through the Hanoi Hilton, and he would give them kind of a tour of, there's certainly some propaganda in the Hanoi Hilton about how great the prisoners were treated. Mm-hmm. He would disavow the audience of say this is not exactly how things were, but explain a little bit of what was going on. But what Senator McCain was he was a real healer. I think for him it was he had been on the USS John McCain before. But it was a real symbol of where military relations between two countries had gone and where we have come from and where we are potentially going to.
Well, you mentioned his role in Congress. He is instrumental in moving forward with normalization because once McCain sends the message that I think it's time to do this, who more qualified than John McCain to talk about it's time to put this behind us?
Yeah, he's you know, it's very important to honor our history, and I think the United States is doing some great things by working on some of the war legacy issues over in Vietnam, such as doing some dioxin remediation or Agent Orange remediation. Right. We did some work there in Da Nang. We've just started a project down at an area in the south called Bien Hoa. Mm-hmm. And this is good because what this does is there's this cadre of people in Vietnam who fought against us. And what this shows is that we are honoring some of the history that we have, a very difficult history that both nations have had to share, mm-hmm. and trying to make things a little bit better for Vietnamese. And what right. that does is it turns people who were maybe against the United States or at least opposed to the United States, and it makes us friends. So it gives us a path forward to advance other areas of relationships. So working on war legacies issues is a very, very important part of our future relationship.
Right. And let's talk for a moment about the legacy back here, and that is POW-MIAs. There is an agency within the Defense Department, the POW-MIA Accounting Agency. Last month, Chris, was National POW-MIA Recognition Day. Since 1973, we've found the remains of about 1,000 Americans killed during the conflict. More than 1,500 Americans, though, still remain unaccounted for. As a naval attaché, are you involved at all in MIA relations, or is that a completely different part of the Pentagon?
No, that's a great question. The POW-MIA office is actually a very, very important office because that office was established in Vietnam before the United States Embassy was established. Mm-hmm. This was the first area of collaboration or cooperation that we had with Vietnam in the post-war years. The cooperation there, and it's excellent cooperation with the Vietnamese side, was one of the facilitating steps that enabled the embassy to ultimately be established and for our diplomatic relations to be established in 1995. So the team there is actually, because it predated the embassy, it has an administrative tie to the embassy, but it's actually still a separate facility and a separate unit from the embassy. So we work very closely with them. Of course, we will be very aware of when they're involved in various briefings or when they're doing repatriation efforts. And when they do find remains, it's a very ceremonial time that we can go spend, go to the airports and do the repatriations of remains. It's an honor to work with that team, but it is distinctly different than the embassy itself.
Mm-hmm. We haven't talked much about your time in China. Compare and contrast life in Beijing versus life in Hanoi. I assume you were you based in Hanoi, Beijing, or elsewhere?
Yeah, I was. I was in Beijing while I was in China, and then in Hanoi while I was in Vietnam. You know, the time, both countries are incredibly strategic. Mm-hmm. The opportunity to be a naval attaché in China was one of the most job-rewarding experiences I had ever had. When you can sit down across the table from a senior U.S. diplomat or a senior U.S. Politician and you can convey some ideas or a talking point that you think is important or that is important to the Department of Defense, and then you hear them walk in or you see them walk into a meeting and then they use that talking point, and it's a key talking point in the bilateral relationship between the United States and China, it's a pretty rewarding experience. Mm-hmm. It gave me a chance to advance military relations in a country that it's very, very difficult to advance relationships. That said, it was incredibly challenging while I was in Beijing. Everything in Beijing is reciprocity-based. That means that if we do something in the United States, they're going to do something in China. We just saw this week, in fact. For years and years, Beijing has required diplomats to notify headquarters of when U.S. diplomats are going to be going outside the city. Well, Washington has caught on to this reciprocity thing, and now we've instituted the same thing. So, working in Beijing was very difficult for really a combination of reasons. First, when you're dealing with the PLA, because everything's reciprocity based, there's a lot of arguments. It's diplomatic arguments, but it's exhausting. It's an exhausting just to work through what would be relatively, you'd think, very minor problems. But everything has challenges when you're dealing with the PLA. When you combine that with the pollution situation mm-hmm. in Beijing, and quite honestly, a kind of overall counterintelligence environment there. It's a pretty challenging environment to be working in. It was a great place. It was a lot of job satisfaction, but a very difficult experience to be working in there.
Now, is counterintelligence, Chris, a nice way of saying you're being spied upon?
Well, that's one way of putting it.
What is it like to live in a country knowing that you're probably being watched?
Well, if, you know, as long as you're always doing the right thing, right. You don't have to worry about it. Mm-hmm. But it's a little unnerving. But if you go in eyes wide open and you know that this is what's happening, it's something you get used to.
Interesting. So I assume that you're a very intellectually curious man. You obviously like to write, so I assume you like to read. What did you try to learn in your time in these two countries?
I think...
I'm curious about it in this regard. You obviously are posted in these two nations. You're very busy with your job, but you have downtime, so you have a chance to travel. You have a chance to mix with society, and you have a chance to learn about culture.
Absolutely, and that's you highlighted exactly what I think was one of the most rewarding parts about living in both countries was learning about the culture. You know, in China, Beijing, certainly the Han people are the predominant people, but that's only one part of China. Now, it's the most numerous part of China in terms of the people, but China's a very large country, and there are segments of China that don't necessarily identify. They're certainly not Han. They're other ethnic minorities, but they also have their own positions and perspectives about Beijing, and so the opportunity for me, when I would have downtime, the opportunity to travel, to go to especially Western China, up in northwest, the Xinjiang region, which is where the Uyghur minority is located. And you've probably heard about the Uyghur minority in the news recently and some of the internment camps. And going down to Tibet and then southwest China, it gave you a perspective of the diversity in China. You know, we focus in on Beijing a lot, and that's rightfully so. It's a capital. It's what we should be looking at. But there is a wide range of perspectives of what China is when you bounce around the country.
And you had family in tow for this, right?
I did. I have a wonderful wife and two kids.
One of whom I met at a football game. How did the wife and kids adjust to life overseas?
Well, my son would still like to be living overseas. He is absolutely convinced that's what he wants to do for the rest of his life.
Okay.
Both kids speak Chinese. My daughter's at college out at the University of Virginia. She's a sophomore this year. And my son is a freshman in high school. And, you know, for them coming back, I think what we've had is more reverse culture shock in adjusting from classes that or a school that is 600 people in total to a class that is 600 people for my son. So there's been some challenges in coming back, but both kids have been warmly embraced since they've come back. They absolutely love it overseas.
Just to clarify, you're not saying that life is less complicated in a communist country than in Northern California.
I'm not quite saying that. But
it's a culture shock.
It is a culture shock nonetheless.
That's good.
Especially in Silicon Valley. It's expensive here.
So an American looking to travel abroad looks at China and their very obvious destinations, Shanghai, Beijing, the Great Wall. But an American looks to go to Vietnam. What is a good itinerary for going to Vietnam?
What I tell people is if you're going to go to Vietnam, you want to spend at least a week in Vietnam. And there's different regions of Vietnam that you can go to for different kinds of experience. I think there are three primary areas I would focus on. I think it's very important to go to Hanoi to see the capital, to see the communist government and how it's set up, and Ho Chi Minh Mausoleum, and get
McCain,
a sense of
it. There's a McCain statue. Right?
Visit the McCain statue right there on Truckback Lake, a great place to spend some time. But it's also important to go down the coast. I think going down the coast to a city like Da Nang is a great location to go to because it shows one of these cities. It's not a capital city. It's not a Hanoi. It's not a Saigon or Ho Chi Minh City that is really advanced and really leaning forward in the direction that it's going. Wide streets, a very controlled environment, a very nice place to visit. And of course, it's right next to the cultural city of Hoi An, which is another wonderful place to go to.
Speaking of which, I get emails constantly from the Four Seasons chain, which is trying to get me to go to the Four Seasons at Hoi An Beach.
Very, very good place to go to. I can't say I've ever stayed there. It was outside of the government per diem rate when I was there, but it's still a nice place to visit. The third place I would make sure you spend some time and travel down to is actually getting down to Ho Chi Minh City or Saigon. And there, that's kind of like the New York of Vietnam. It's kind of the business district, whereas you have the government district up in Hanoi. Now you get the business district down in Ho Chi Minh City.
So it's a little like D.C. and New York.
Very much. It's a good parallel. There are different people. It's different dialect of Vietnamese between the north and the south still.
Mm-hmm.
But it's... It gives you a very different flavor of the diversity of the country if you can bounce and hit all three spots.
And if you go to Ho Chi Minh City, which is formerly Saigon, is there still a French flavor to it, or what do you experience?
Well, what I like to say is that one of the things that Vietnam did well is when they expelled the French is they kept the French cuisine and they kept a lot of the French infrastructure, such as the wide boulevards, the beautiful trees down in Ho Chi Minh City. So there is still very much of a French influence, although you have to start looking a little bit deeper to see it. But the food itself is a great blend of both European and Vietnamese food mashed together into great fusion.
Sounds good. So final question, we've got you here for the academic year, correct?
That's correct.
What are you studying?
So looking at a combination of things, I think one of the areas that I want to focus on or that I am focusing on is taking a look at especially the Southeast Asian nations as they hedge, as they look at China, they look at the United States, and they're debating what direction they want to go and where do they want to kind of put their eggs in what basket. What can the United States do either better? What can we capitalize on to cause them to want to work closer with us? Sometimes it may mean that they're not actually working with us directly. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it may mean working with one of our partners. And a partner can be the face of the relationship, and we can be in the background. And so I'm taking a look at ways that we can do that perhaps a little better than we're doing right now.
Very good. And do you already know your next post, or when will that be decided?
Well, that'll be decided, I think, in the near future. My hunch is at this point in my career that I will go to the Pentagon, which I have to be careful about this, but I call it the five-sided puzzle palace. But it's most likely a place I'd very much like to go on to work some policy jobs, perhaps even National Security Council, working Asia issues. But we'll see. But yeah, I'm at the mercy of the Navy. They will decide ultimately where I go.
So that would be working for a deputy secretary or for the chiefs? What exactly the Pentagon would you be doing?
Well, I think at the OSD level, the OSD policy level is kind of where I think is one of the areas that I'm most interested in working to. So the Office of Secretary of Defense, OSD, and working for one of the deputy assistant secretaries of defense on Asia issues specifically would be the area that I'd be interested in.
Sounds good. Well, good to have you here at Stanford and Hoover. I hope you enjoy your time on the campus, and I hope your kids make sense of Northern California.
Well, thanks, Bill. I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity.
Captain Chris Sherman, thanks for the conversation.
Have a great day.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to America's 45th president. In this case, the challenges that America has in dealing with Vietnam. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us, and tell your friends all about us. You can find the Hoover Institution online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover's fellows. That certainly includes Captain Christopher Sharman, straight to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Captain Christopher Sharman, I do not believe, is on Twitter.
I'm on LinkedIn. That's the one place I've been in.
Anyway, Captain, enjoy your time here at Hoover. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, Bill.
For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.